well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Attorney Dan Hagan up in Massachusetts about a case I wrote about earlier this week at Bearing Arms involving a young man who was originally charged with nearly a dozen felonies that could have put him in prison for decades for possessing items that the state of Massachusetts says he's not allowed to possess. Problem is that actually he is allowed to possess these items. And Dan Hagan successful in getting about half of these charges dropped so far, and hopefully more to come. But I got to tell you, I mean, this is just one area where Massachusetts gun laws are really, I mean, I think entrapping lawful gun owners. I don't think that's putting it, I don't think it's overstating the case here. You've got people who are not violating Massachusetts gun laws, but because of the way these laws are written, because of the lack of education on the part of law enforcement, you've got individuals who risk the possibility of, you know, a year or more in prison for something that is not a crime. And this is a really dangerous situation. So I appreciate all of the work that Dan Hagan is doing. It's a great conversation. Troubling, but a good conversation. Take a look and a listen. Dan, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again, sir.
Great to see you again, Cam.
And I know that Massachusetts keeps you awfully busy. No shortage of clients, unfortunately, dealing with the Massachusetts gun laws. But there was one case in particular that the Gun Owners Action League has been talking about. This is a case of a gentleman who was arrested, basically had a protective order filed against him. I don't think it lasted very long. I think the person who filed it recanted a short time later. But in the short time that this was in effect, police go to his house to take his firearms license, to take his firearms, and they discover, quote unquote, assault weapons, unserialized firearms, unsafe storage, charge him with, you know, you could tell me how many felonies he was originally charged with. But the good news is that you've been able to get a lot of these charges dropped, right?
Yeah, that's correct, Cam. So he was originally charged with I believe 11 felonies, five assault weapons violations, which in Massachusetts just got a lot more complicated with the passage of Chapter 135 back in 2024. There's multiple exception dates now that these firearms could fall into, but the police went ahead, charged him anyways with that. They also charged him with six counts of having an untraceable firearm, which means a firearm without a serial number on it. And what's sad about that is that the Executive Office of Public Safety and Security, who administers the regulations around registration and serialization, came out with regulations saying you don't have to register or you don't have to serialize or register your firearms until October of 2026. So here he is charged with six counts, pretty serious crimes, and it's not even in effect yet. So clearly shows that the police don't really understand this stuff. And everyone, you know, and obviously if the police can't understand it, and even lawyers like myself and other lawyers who do this, I mean, we struggle with exactly what is exempt, like in the assault weapons ban, what's not, and we can disagree. And yet the average citizen's being held to account with felonies if they get it wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane. As you say, if police and prosecutors don't even understand what the law says. So the assault weapon charges, prosecutor agreed not to pursue an indictment for those charges, right?
That's correct, Cam. So with the assault weapons violations in Massachusetts, it's bad because it's very serious. It can only be handled in the superior court. So in Massachusetts, there's two levels of court. There's a district court, which handles your, you know, less serious criminal cases. And then there's the superior court, which handles your most serious criminal cases, like murders, rapes, robberies, drug traffickers, violent criminals, those sorts of things. The charges, an assault weapons ban violation for somebody who has a license, but is maybe has a feature that they shouldn't have or a copy and duplicate of something they shouldn't have, can only be prosecuted in the superior court with the murderers, rapists, drug traffickers, those people. Now, well, that's bad, but through goals advocacy and work I've done out here in Western Massachusetts, I think there's a certain level of understanding over these prosecutors now, and they're getting some reasonable ones who are saying, well, we're not going to spend prosecutorial resources on that type of violation, because that, you know, to indict somebody, you have to bring them in order to get to the Superior Court. You got to bring them in front of a grand jury. You got to put time, resources, and everything else into that. And they have just too much to do, too many real actual crimes and actual serious cases. And so you are starting to see some of that out here. And I think that's thanks to Goal and, you know, others' advocacy on the topic to start educating, you know, and I know the prosecutors and the police are starting to listen. And I think that's a testament to why we need these, you know, gun groups. Even in a state like Massachusetts, we can make a difference. You know,
absolutely. How, you know, again, man, you talk about the possession of the unserialized firearms, and as you say, the law doesn't even take effect. I mean, you have until October of this year to serialize your unserialized firearms. Right. I don't know what you can talk about with an ongoing case, but have you had any discussions with the prosecutor about those charges? I'm surprised that those charges are still out there.
Right. So the first step was dropping the assault weapons charges. I anticipate, okay, I'm in talks with the firearms unit now, and they have a very sharp prosecutor on this case. And I anticipate that those will also be getting dropped. So I think this is going to look much less serious than it did at the outset, and probably be some type of improper storage type case in the end. And but remember, when he first got charged, they asked, he's 23 years old, and the government asked for a $25,000 cash bail on him, which would almost assure he would be locked up until trial. And you can actually hear, I posted the bail argument on that so people can hear, you know, what can happen to you and how everything went. I put it on my social media, and Goal, Gun Owners Action League, also put it on their social media as well.
You know, and again, I mean, we're talking about, at the end of the day, again, laws that I think are either not in effect or difficult to enforce, but we're talking about possessory offenses, right? As you say, you know, the Superior Court is supposed to be dealing with murderers, rapists, armed robbers, home invaders. Possessing a firearm that, as you say, has a feature, right, that's banned, and all of a sudden now the gun becomes banned. What is the penalty under Massachusetts law for possessing, for mere possession of an assault weapon?
Sure. So there's a 1 year mandatory minimum in state prison and up to 10 years in state prison for one of those counts. So that's the penalty. Amazing. But again, are they going to spend the time and the resources to put these defendants into Superior Court once we educate a little bit as to what this really means? It's somebody with a license who, as you said, has a feature or a copy or duplicate, which, and the other thing the prosecutors, I think, realize is this is no slam dunk for them, because the way the law is written, there are multiple exceptions and there are, you know, exemptions that these guns could fall into. And so it's a dogfight. So you're taking a case which in all seriousness is not serious, and you're going to have a dogfight if you get it into Superior Court over what these dates actually mean and represent and whether these guns fall into exceptions. So I think the combination of that and Goal's advocacy has helped, at least out here in the western part of the state, have some reasonable touches taken to these cases by the prosecutors.
Okay. And that's good to hear. But at the same time, as I said, you're plenty busy. You've got plenty of clients, you know, and a lot of these cases are really, in my opinion, really questionable. Kyle Collada comes to mind, the Air Force veteran. I know we've talked about this on a number of occasions with Jim Wallace from Goal, as well as you. You know, here is a guy who is basically living out of his car with his girlfriend. They're on their way to their girlfriend's family's place. They're trying to earn a couple of bucks for gas and food by doing deliveries. They get pulled over for, I think it was an expired tag or something like that, right? And then the car ends up getting towed. Kyle Collada, you know, tells the officer, hey, I've got firearms in my car, which leads to him being arrested, him being accused of being a danger to the Commonwealth there. And he's held without bond for 4 months, I think it was, right?
120 days, correct.
Gee, many Christmas. So what is the latest on Kyle's case? Because, again, I mean, yes, he's accused of nothing more than possessing firearms in Massachusetts without a license, essentially, right?
That's correct. That's correct, Cam. So Kyle case is all too common here in the state, that it mass serves as the trap for, you know, folks traveling through this state or newly arriving to this state. Remember, in all these cases, both the assault weapons cases we're talking about or the non-resident who travels into Massachusetts, even if you fall into an exemption or exception to the law, you know, you still get arrested, you still go to court, you still have to hire someone like myself to, in many cases, it, the way that I believe Massachusetts courts are going to interpret these is that it's an affirmative defense at trial if the prosecutor doesn't back down. So therefore, you have to go to trial and establish, hey, Kyle was just passing through the state, Kyle had newly moved to the state. You know, those sorts of exemptions have to be proven to a jury. And then the prosecutor has to disprove them beyond a reasonable doubt. But you have to at least offer evidence of that. So that's where we stand with Kyle's case is we're trying to work it out with the prosecutors. You know, Kyle's a veteran, and we have specialized courts here that deal with people who are veterans and are service connected. And they'll, if you can work it out with them, they'll break the charges down to something much less serious and allow him to go to a veterans court. And it's, that's a possibility for Kyle. One, I think that, you know, I believe he should have. I mean, he's a, you know, served overseas, honorably discharged, never committed a crime in his life, kind of tailor-made for what those courts were meant to do to help veterans. So if he doesn't, if they won't let him in, the prosecutor has to agree to drop the charges. If they don't let him into that, then we'll be picking a trial date at the next hearing coming up here in a couple of weeks.
How many other cases like Kyle's are you dealing with right now, Dan?
I have a handful of others. You know, they come in all the time. One was very sad, very tragic. I won't mention the person's name, but I just got it in a week or so ago. A young boy, I believe late teens, early 20s, was leaving Vermont. He, in the process, left some suicide notes to his father and sister. The father's a police officer. The father immediately calls Massachusetts State Police. They track his phone. They realize he's coming down the interstate here in Springfield, and they pull him over. And when they pull him over, how does the Mass State Police help the situation? They charge him with multiple felonies. And this is just a young man that needed help, never committed a crime in his life. He's a very good, nice young man, hardworking kid, going to college, needed help. And now you're trapped in this Massachusetts gun maze where he could have been held as a dangerous person. I mean, I had to talk to the prosecutors to say, hey, listen, please don't treat him like you did, you know, this wasn't this office that handled Kyle, but please don't move for dangerousness. Hey, can we agree on to release him? You know, can we get bail for him? And, you know, thankfully the prosecutor, they agreed to release him on $2,500 cash and we got him out. But there's an exemption now in 135. And that's what's so frustrating about this is there's an exemption in the law, which is supposed to be beneficial to the non-resident coming through this state. That was newly added in Chapter 135 that said you can travel through Massachusetts as a non-resident with a firearm on your person, you know? And so here's this young man in possession of a firearm. By all accounts, there's no disputing this. He was traveling through the state of Massachusetts. Police completely unaware of the exception or don't care. And now he's charged with multiple felonies and facing mandatory minimum jail time. I mean, the kid, if he gets convicted, he's going to jail for a minimum of 18 months. And so that's a sad case. And it's something that just shouldn't be happening here.
Yeah.
And it's all too common, unfortunately.
Yeah, you know, and I want to talk about this exception for a second, because, again, I mean, if the law is it just a matter of the law not being clear? I mean, I can't understand how a prosecutor would not be able to look at that statute and say, I don't have a crime to prosecute here.
Right. Right. Well, it's I think the problem is this law is somewhat new. We're starting to encounter these issues now. And I don't think the education and training, the state has not educated or trained very well law enforcement or the prosecutors on what some of these new laws mean and what these new exemptions are. I mean, I'm the one raising them and bringing them to folks' attention and saying, hey, hold on a second. You know, there's an exemption here. Even the judges are not familiar with that. You know, they're familiar with other exemptions that have been previous mass laws, but this is new. So there's an education process, and unfortunately, there's a few people are going to be guinea pigs going through this first to establish exactly what that exception means. And as I said, is it an exception that means that they have to disprove that as an element of the crime? Or is it, which I believe in Massachusetts, the way the courts will look at it, is that we need, it's something we could offer at trial. Now, most reasonable prosecutors, you would hope, would look at it and dismiss the case, or handle it much differently, much less seriously. But there's no guarantee of that. And again, there's good prosecutors. It's a decent office that I work with a large amount of time out here. And some of the surrounding offices are fairly decent. But you never know. And that can change on a dime. I mean, we're dealing with prosecutorial discretion. And you can sometimes be prosecutor to prosecutor. So no one's taking a firm stand saying, hey, we're not going to prosecute these laws or we're going to do these things. It is Massachusetts. But we are starting to see some people coming around and I think being a little more reasonable and how they approach these. So if there's some silver lining, that's it. But these cases of the non-residents coming through where there's an exception right on point, totally unacceptable.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is something that gun owners who might be traveling through Massachusetts need to be very concerned about and be aware of, that even if the law says you can have the gun on your person, as long as you're traveling through, what the law says and what police say, yeah, what prosecutors say might be something very different.
Yeah, you better be ready to defend yourself. I mean, even when you read the law and say, oh, I have an exception applies to me, you have to be ready to defend yourself. I mean, my advice would be, look, if you're, I think you're crazy right now without a non-resident LTC to bring a firearm into Massachusetts, just because who wants to go through that process? Let, you know, there's going to be guinea pigs. There already are folks going through this process. Let's get that ironed out a little bit more before folks start trying to exercise that exception. It's sad to say that, but, you know, I try to keep people out of jail, Cam.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I, you know, listen, I'm right there with you. I mean, I'm going to be going to Massachusetts. I'll see you on Saturday at the Gun Owners Action League event in Boxborough. I don't have a non-resident permit. I'm not carrying.
I'll represent you pro bono. No. I'll represent you pro bono. If you get...
I appreciate that. Still not worth it to me. Thankfully, I'll be around a lot of gun owners, so they're going to have to protect me. But, right, you know, it is amazing to me. It still is infuriating to me that my Second Amendment rights stop at the state line where I live. And, you know, I was born in Massachusetts. I live in Virginia now. It's perfectly legal for me to carry in the state where I live. I could go to prison if I bring my gun with me to the state where I was born, because my Second Amendment rights do not apply there.
Right. What other constitutional right works like that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's
not just supposed to be a second class right. It's not supposed to be a second class.
Absolutely. But, you know, again, thanks to your work, the group, you know, the work of groups like GOAL, I think that things are hopefully starting to change. We've got the ATF proposed rule that I think would clarify a lot of things under the Firearms Owner Protection Act, so that people who, you know, are traveling, even without Chapter 135 coming into play, you could stop overnight. You could stop to fill up your car. If your car breaks down, you can get it repaired. You don't have to worry about getting hit with, you know, federal charges. So I think we are, it's tough sometimes, I think, for gun owners. I'm not sure we're as good at playing the long game as gun control advocates are, because our rights are being violated. We want the fix now. You know, and we should get the fix now. I understand the frustration, but I think we are making some progress, and it is slow. Right. It is uneven. Sometimes it's two steps forward, one steps back. But I think because of the work of gun owners and advocates in Massachusetts is, you know, I got to tell you, for a state that is so hostile to our right to keep our arms, there are so many Second Amendment champions in the state of Massachusetts. It's one of the reasons why I never say no when I get the opportunity to visit gun owners there, because you guys are inspirations to me. You really are.
Well, thank you, Cam. We appreciate that a lot. And, you know, you're right. Massachusetts is a battleground state as much as we can make it. You know, obviously we're behind enemy lines here, so it's not easy. And we have to look at wins, I think, a little different. I mean, for the large systemic changes that we all want, and GOAL wants, I want, everyone wants here, that's really reliant on the U.S. Supreme Court taking some action, taking some cases, which hopefully happen in the next term or two, as Justice Kavanaugh said. But in the meantime, I think it is very much a win if you can educate the police, educate the prosecutors, because their law can be on the books, but if it's not being enforced to the severity of which it can be, that is a measure of a win when you don't have a Supreme Court yet taken some cases that can really clarify and really help mass gun owners. So we have to take the wins where we can, and we have to fight at all levels, you know, the courts, education, legislatively. And that's how you can turn things around. And that's how you can, you know, move the needle, even in a state as bad as Massachusetts.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all the work you're doing to both defend gun owners and to educate the prosecutors and the police and the judges as to what Massachusetts law actually says. Dan, appreciate you joining me on the program today, and looking forward to seeing you this weekend.
Absolutely, Cam. We'll see you at the 250th.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Take care.
And thanks to Dan for joining us on the program. And, you know, look, we don't get to Massachusetts overnight, right? But if we don't stand up and defend our right to keep and bear arms in the states where we live, we can get to Massachusetts a lot sooner than you might think. I mean, again, the span of 5 months here in Virginia, Democrats enacted more than a dozen gun control bills, and they've got more lined up and ready to go next session. I will not be surprised if we see a ban on the possession of so-called assault firearms and large capacity magazines in the state, a permit to purchase handguns, bills that were left on the table this session, 11% excise tax on firearms ammunition, $500 tax on the suppressors. We may see a bill just to ban possession of suppressors outright. We've got that at the federal level introduced by a New Jersey Democrat. As soon as the anti-gunners have the power in the state house, as soon as they've got a governor who will go along with their anti-gun agenda, they're pushing as hard as they can. I said when we were talking to Dan that I think gun control activists are maybe sometimes better about playing the long game. I think they've actually lost more than they've gained in the long run. But they are happy with whatever progress they can make. And if that means in a pro-gun state, they simply stop pro-gun bills from advancing, they're fine with that. Like New Hampshire, for example. You had a campus carry bill. You had preemption. They're great with those bills not getting to the governor. Would they like to see a ban on so-called assault weapons in New Hampshire? Absolutely. Would they like to turn New Hampshire into Massachusetts? Oh, of course they would. But they're more than happy at this point, given the political realities, to simply stop good bills from advancing, or good bills from our perspective. When they do have that majority, though, they are pushing as hard as they can to go as far as they can. And if they don't get their way, they don't bash, the leadership of the Democrat Party. They don't bash the governor. They'll bash the gun lobby, right? They'll bash gun owners, Second Amendment supporters. But they get right to work at advancing that same bill next year, the following session, right? We can see this in New Mexico, for example, with the ban on gas-operated semi-automatic firearms, did not pass into law this year, despite the best efforts of anti-gun Democrats, despite the best efforts of Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, who really wanted to sign a gun ban before her term as governor was up. And when that bill failed in the final days of the legislative session, gun control advocates, they held their fire, so to speak. They didn't bash those Democrats who refused to bring that bill forward. They complained about gun owners. They complained about the gun lobby. And behind the scenes, they were already working at peeling away some of those no votes and getting them to yes next session. All that being said, it's incumbent on gun owners, no matter where you live. If you live in a ruby red state, you live in a deep blue state, it is incumbent to keep up the fight, to safeguard the Second Amendment freedoms that you currently enjoy, to work to expand those freedoms, and if you live in a state like Massachusetts, to claw back those freedoms. And that is the toughest fight of all. I believe it is much easier to hang on to the freedoms that we have than to regain the liberties lost, but again, they're doing a fantastic job of Second Amendment activism up in Massachusetts, and it is one of the reasons why every time I get the opportunity to spend some time with gun owners in that state, I am going to say yes, and I'm looking forward to being there in Massachusetts this weekend. All right. On to today's Armed Citizen Story, our good deed of the day. In our recidivist report, which comes to us from Cincinnati, Ohio, the headline from the Inquirer, man wanted by cops before skyline stabbing, why wasn't he in jail? It's a good question. And I don't know that there is a really good answer. Alyssa Hill stabbed to death inside a Skyline Chili location. And as the Inquirer notes, after that happened, people blamed the judge who put the accused attacker on probation. But Hamilton County Municipal Court Judge Samantha Silverstein and the county's probation department say there are gaps in the system that allowed for Rick Wright to stay on the street. Wright was already wanted by police the day after he was charged with stabbing Hill, who was his ex-girlfriend and a waitress at Skyline Chili. Months earlier, he had stopped going to his court-ordered addiction program. He had stopped checking in with his probation officer. Silverstein, who was the one who placed Wright on probation in the first place, told the Inquirer that she had no idea that he had violated his probation until after the stabbing. Neither did the police officers in Norwood, Ohio, who regularly encountered him in the early months of his probation. Wright was originally charged, by the way, with assault on a police officer. That was back in February of 2025. Charged was misdemeanor assault, carried a maximum sentence of 6 months in prison. Instead, he was sentenced to a year of probation in March of last year. He had already been in jail for a month at the time, which would have counted towards his sentence. The judge said had she sentenced him to the maximum, he would have been out by August of last year. And there would have been no probation after his release because it was a misdemeanor. Okay. I mean, you want to make the case that the society was better off by putting him on a year's probation than putting him in jail for 6 months. Okay, make the case. But here's the thing. He violated that probation, right? He stopped doing what he was supposed to do. And what happened? Nothing. Nothing happened. So was society really better off with this guy being on probation for a year rather than 6 months in jail, given that there were no consequences to him violating probation until after he was arrested for allegedly stabbing his ex-girlfriend? Or would society have been better off had this guy actually been sentenced to 6 months in jail, done 6 months in jail, maybe learned a lesson while he was spending 6 months in jail, and maybe when he got out, he would have been less inclined to continue on with further violent acts. Silverstein says that generally in Ohio, judges are not kept in the loop about how someone violated the probation when an arrest warrant is issued. She says sometimes another judge might sign the warrant, but even then, she says most of the details are left until the person appears in court. She says no judge has real-time knowledge of every person who's currently in violation status or every person who is successfully complying with probation conditions. Okay. And why is that? Well, I mean, again, that, by the way, a judge doesn't necessarily have to be in the loop. That to me is not where the problem lies. To me, the problem is that you can violate the terms of your probation. You can stop attending that court-ordered treatment. You can stop checking in with your probation officer. But if you don't, or if you do those things, nothing really happens. I mean, a warrant was put out for this individual's arrest. But as the Inquirer says, it's unclear in court records whether police made any attempt to track Wright down. They had the arrest warrant. If they ran into him, they had a warrant to pick him up. If they didn't run into him, he was just going to be free and loose. The Inquirer says that misdemeanor warrants are a low priority, officials say. Across Hamilton County, Ohio, which is Cincinnati, more than 120,000 active warrants of all types, according to the judge. She says warrants are served by priority, including if there are violations of having a court order to stay away from another person, such as in domestic violence situations or other urgent circumstances. She says warrants in misdemeanor cases are given the lowest priority. Okay. Municipal Court's Chief Probation Officer Kevin Bonecutter said after they learned that Wright had left treatment, was no longer at his last known address, they issued a warrant but did not make an attempt to track him down. He said in general, warrants are just entered into the system and made available to law enforcement. Okay. Again, that's the way it is. Is that the way it should be? Is that the way it should be? I think is the question. Now, in this case, the Inquirer also has a little sub-headline in this story. A community calls judge culpable in Hill's death. Some Cincinnati politicians say she's too leaning on repeat offenders, issues bonds that are too low as a municipal court judge. Cincinnati's police union has said that she was in part responsible for this murder. Again, based on the charges and the potential for sentencing here, 6 months maximum in jail, a year probation. Actually, I think in Ohio, you get misdemeanors are eligible by up to 5 years probation. Was the judge culpable? I don't know that you can actually say that, given that had he been sentenced to jail, he would have been out right? His sentence would have been served. The stabbing happened on June 2nd of this year. He was sentenced in March of 2025. So even if he had, and he had already spent a month in jail at that point, so you're looking at 5 more months. So he'd have been out in August of last year. He would have been out for almost a year, and he would have been on probation. Because again, once you serve a misdemeanor sentence, there is no probation attached. So I don't think it's fair to say that the judge is culpable in this case. Again, you can argue, well, maybe Rick Wright would have learned a lesson had he been sentenced to 6 months in jail. Maybe he would have been less likely to commit this crime. But that's still on him. That's not on the judge. So I'm not going to blame this particular judge. I will say, however, that the system's messed up. Hey, if you got 120,000 active warrants in one county, man, that's a massive number of warrants, right? And again, we can't put out, you know, BOLO alerts for every person with a warrant. We can't have police just running around all day trying to serve warrants and track down these individuals who are, wanted for not complying with the terms of their probation. At the same time, when we do catch up to these individuals, there need to be consequences. In this case, they caught up with Rick Wright after he allegedly murdered somebody, right? But in other cases, you might get pulled over for a traffic stop. Maybe it is a low-level drug offense. And all too often, what happens in these cases is that the probation is simply extended. The original sentence is not imposed. Somebody gets a slap on the wrist, and the clock starts again, essentially. That's not how a functioning criminal justice system should work. And it sounds like in Hamilton County, Ohio, I'm not really sure it's fair to say they've got a functional criminal justice system at this point. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story. It's a tale of two headlines from Miami Gardens, Florida. Here's the first one. Suspect shot and killed during robbery attempt at Miami Gardens home. So this was the initial report that came out a couple of days ago. NBC South Florida, Channel 6, said that it happened early Tuesday morning, about 1:30 in the morning. Miami Gardens police said the suspect tried to rob a house and the victim had opened his door to the suspect before they got into a physical altercation. President's girlfriend then ran to a neighbor's home for help, and at some point the suspect fired a gun. That's when the neighbor ran over, armed as well, and shot the suspect in the head. He was taken to a local hospital where he was later pronounced dead. So that's the first story. There was one local report from a neighbor who said, we look out for each other in this community. Here's the second headline. This was yesterday. This was Wednesday. Miami Gardens robbery victim, girlfriend, arrested after search warrant uncovers over $6 million in cash and drugs. All right, so now we know a little bit more about why perhaps that robbery took place, right? This was not just some random home invasion, likely a targeted attack. Now, the neighbor is still, not been arrested, not been accused of any crime. As far as the investigation shows up to this point, the neighbor was acting in defense of others and likely will not face charges. The robbery victims, on the other hand, will be facing charges because of the allegations that they were essentially running a drug operation out of their home there in the Miami Gardens. We'll try to keep an eye on this case. I hope that there are no more twists and turns here. I'm certainly glad that the armed citizen who acted in defense of his neighbor, not facing any charges at this point, nor should they be. I mean, this really was a case where somebody's life was in danger, regardless of their criminal activity. Somebody's life was in danger. Somebody runs over, help me. And this armed citizen wanted to help out his neighbor and save a life, shot and killed a man who was threatening him. that should not warrant any charges here. But again, we will look to see if any future updates reveal any more twists and turns in the investigation. And finally today, our good deed of the day, the headline doesn't really capture this situation either. Kidnapping suspect posing as cop parked at gate leading to bomb plant, investigators say. A truck driver witness says suspect already cut lock leading to the Savannah River site. The truck driver witness was actually in a position to save the kidnapping victim here. I would have gone with that as the headline. But WRDW, WAGT in South Carolina decided to go with that mouthful that I just mentioned here. Truck driver's name is Anthony. His last name not being used. His dash camera actually helped to lead deputies to an arrest, at least according to the investigators who arrived there on the scene. He said the lieutenant came out after for a few hours. He came over to me and said, undoubtedly, you saved that young lady's life, because he said there was a chain around a fence like a cattle fence. He'd already got the lock on that fence to take her down there. As Anthony was driving down this pretty rural road, he said that he just happened to be in the right place at the right time. He said, if I was 30 seconds to a minute earlier, or 30 seconds to a minute later, he said, I would have missed this entire situation. He said, everything that happened with that put me at that spot. It was God. He said, it's nothing short of a miracle. So he's driving down this road, and all of a sudden he sees this young woman get out of a green Cadillac DeVille and start running. And he called 911 and he said, we've got a girl out here running for her life. Anthony said, I was thinking, man, it's Friday. A couple got into it. He said, but when I saw the pursuit, he said, I knew that's not what it was, because that person was trying to run the other person over in the car. And then Anthony realized that the young woman actually had handcuffs on her. Anthony described the suspect's appearance as, he said his face was real dirty, cigarette hanging out of his mouth, said the back windshield of the car was busted out, plastic gray duct tape around the window, and he said, if you were a cop, you'd at least acknowledge me when I walked up to your car and not speed off, which is what the suspect did. The young woman told Anthony that the man had claimed to be a law enforcement officer, placed her in handcuffs. She told deputies that she was able to escape when he stopped near a pasture gate and got out to rummage through the trunk of the vehicle. She's able to crawl out through an open door, and that's when she started running. The gate in question leads to some dirt roads on federal property towards the Savannah River site. But again, very secluded area, not likely to generate a immediate response. Or quite frankly, the suspect may not have realized that this was, you know, federal property he was getting ready to go on to. Anthony's wife has spoken with the kidnapping victim. And says that she is hanging in there. 39-year-old Jonathan Willard of New Ellington, has been arrested and charged with these crimes. And Anthony, again, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. In this case, simply calling 911 and sticking around to make sure that that woman wasn't hurt. Anthony, I know you've been thanked before by folks a lot closer to the situation than I am, but we do thank you for your very good deed. And that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. Looking forward to seeing you back here on Monday. Not sure who we'll be talking to, but I know it will be a good conversation. Monday, we've got more orders coming from the Supreme Court. We'll see if we get any news on the hardware cases, and we still have Hamani and Wolford pending before the Supreme Court. We'll see if we get a decision on those cases next week as well. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com, filling you in on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. If you like what you see, we would also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum member. Use the promo code FIGHT, take 60% off your membership. Anybody supporting the work we're doing at Bearing Arms, I want to thank you for that. And hope you have a great weekend. Till we talk again, be well, be safe, and be free.